I'm Lina Khmoudou. Welcome to Health Chat.
We turn now to HIV/AIDS. Josephine Nabukenya is an international advocate for children living with HIV. The young woman from Uganda was born with HIV and discovered her status at the age of 8. She was able to benefit from services provided in her country by the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, a U.S. nonprofit organization that seeks to end global pediatric HIV/AIDS. As an adult, Nabukenya is now sharing her story to bring about change, educate and inspire others in Uganda and beyond. Here is Josephine. I spoke to her recently. Take a listen.
You are an ambassador for the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, and you are currently visiting the USA. Talk to us about your travel here in the USA. What has been on the agenda?
Thank you so much. So I came here on Sunday. And specifically, I came to attend a board meeting, which started on the evening of Monday and throughout Tuesday. So besides being an ambassador for the foundation, I also serve on the board of directors, and I bring my shared experience to the board. So on top of the two meetings that I've had, I've also been able to meet several representatives at the Congress and sharing my story, but also letting them know about the importance that we are receiving through the PEPFAR funds, but also the support that I've received through the foundation.
So you talked about meeting some members of Congress and sharing your story. Talk to us about that story. You were born with HIV. Take us back to that moment when you found out your status. Today you are very vocal and you're sharing your story to help and impact and inspire others. What did you understand at the time that you were diagnosed with HIV regarding the significance of your diagnosis, and how old were you?
Unlike other many children, I found out my HIV status when I was around 8-9 years old, and it was self-discovery. So it's not like I had it from a doctor or from a caregiver or from my parent. So my mother was really very sick, and by that time, ARVs were not easily accessible. So you'd only start ARVs if your immunity is very low and like you're bedridden. So my mother was in that kind of state. She was sick, she was bedridden, she was paralyzed half of her left body. And as a child home, I was doing housework in her bedroom, and that's how I landed on a litter. So I usually say I landed on a litter, but when I hear her side of the story, she says it was a will, because she thought she was going to die, so she needed to leave something behind that would inform us what killed her and what we were like our health status. So the letter disclosed to me that I was living with HIV and that she was also HIV positive. And at that moment, because she was very sick, I could not ask her questions because I knew the state she was in. So I decided to keep quiet, but I clearly understood what it meant, because from school, we learned about HIV, and there are so many several posts around the school compound that had AIDS kills. So I all understood that HIV has no cure, there's no treatment, and I clearly understood that like there is death associated with HIV. But I didn't want to ask my mother so many questions, because I knew she was in a very bad state, and I knew that I was not supposed to read that letter. So that's how I got to know about my HIV status.
So you were very young. What do you remember in terms of some of the challenges once you were diagnosed? What were you confronted with, and how have those challenges evolved over the years?
So my childhood was associated with a lot of sicknesses. I was like a sickly child. Probably on a monthly basis, I would be like admitted. I had like TB several times, I had pneumonia several times, I had a epizoster several times. But unlike other children, like I pulled through. Like so many children do not like make it out of that kind of COVID condition. So I was a very sickly child, but at the age of 13, I started taking ARVs. That is after I'd been like gotten TB and it was so serious. So I got started on ARVs, and one of the biggest challenges I had in my life was treatment, because by then I was taking a syrup, and like you would get a syringe like pull the syrup out of the tin and then measure to see that they're the right milliliters, and then like you take it and swallow it. So I hated the taste of the syrup, and I hated the entire process of taking the syrup. I took it for like a month, and I told my doctors, if you don't change me from this syrup, I will not take it again. Like, I was that open, and I'm so happy that I was treated by a doctor who listened to me. You know, that is something in Africa that it's not common. Several times you say doctor, and in your mind, it's like, this is the final person. Like, I cannot talk and agree with my doctor on what should be for my health. But I had a different kind of, like, setup. Like, I really talked with my doctor, and I explained myself. I told them I was not ready to continue taking the syrup. So because I wasn't eligible for a complete tablet, we had to break tablets. Every time I go to the clinic, I'll go to the doctor, get the prescription, go to the pharmacy, get my tablets, and then go back to the doctor so that we can break the tablets into halves. And I did that until I was eligible for one complete tablet. So I would say throughout this time, adherence and treatment options have been like a challenge for me because I didn't really like the taste of the syrup. And then when I started taking a tripla, that's one pill a day in the evening, it really gave me a very bad side effect. Like, I'd be like a drunkard person. At one point, I was conducting a camp in the evening, like at around, I think it was around 11 p.m. Like, when you're doing camps and you're after the campfire, like, you take long as a facilitator to have the day concluded. So at around 11 p.m. after I'd taken my tablet, I could not stand and walk myself from my chair to, like, to my room because I was feeling like a drunkard person, like I was not stable. So that's the other challenge that I've had to get with that kind of treatment. But currently I'm taking TLD, and I've been so good with TLD. I've not had major side effects, and yes, here I am.
That's very, I mean, that's what a story. What a story. And you talked about treatment adherence and even availability. One of the challenges has been, according to reports and experts, pediatric AIDS and treatment for children. So now you are an adult, but you experienced the challenge of treatment as a child. Working with EGPAF, how has things evolved? What can you tell us in terms of the evolution of treatments for children? Is it still the same problem, or have there been some progress?
So definitely I would say there's been progress, because when I hear from my mother's stories, she says she used to take so many tablets. I mean, I've not had to take so many tablets. The only time I took so many tablets, around 5 to 7, was when I was treating TB. You know, TB has like these different kinds of like many tablets. But with in relation to like ARVs, I only took the syrup, and then I took one tablet in the morning, and then one tablet in the evening, and then later on I started taking one tablet in the evening, and then currently I still take one tablet in the evening. So there is that progress. My mother has had a chance of taking many tablets, and then now she takes around 3 tablets. But I've not had a chance of taking up to more than 2 tablets a day. But I know that there are people that, you know, before I was born, or when I was still young, I know that there are people that have been exposed to taking so many tablets, and that has a lot of pill fatigue and pill burden associated to it. And it's one of the reasons as to why currently adolescents are like failing on treatment. Like, they don't want to take treatment because, you know, the tablets, if there are really very many, definitely for a young person, it could be hard for them to keep up taking up the tablets on a daily basis. But I would say, as I said earlier on, I think there's been great improvement in treatment, not only on the number of tablets, but also on the side effects. And that means a lot, because if I'm to take a tablet and it is giving me all these serious side effects, trust me, I may not be able to take it the next day or the next week or the next month. So there's been improvement in the number of tablets, improvement towards the side effects, but also treatment-wise, like clinical-wise, they say there is improvement in like treatment success. Like when you take Dolutegravir, like it quickly suppresses the HIV virus, and we all want to have a viral load that is suppressed so that one does not even have to, you know, transmit HIV sexually or like be at risk of getting other opportunistic infections.
You talked about the treatment challenges. One of the challenges that people living with HIV and even other chronic diseases have to face is stigma. After you made your status known, because now you're an advocate, you out, everyone know. I mean, people in your circle know that you have the virus. But after you made your status known, how have you dealt with stigma?
Well, I count myself one of the lucky ones because I've not experienced stigma in my family. And I'll be honest with you, as long as HIV lives with us, HIV-related stigma will live with us. And one best example I can give is with COVID. I mean, there was a lot of COVID stigma associated to it in the very beginning. But we see that kind of stigma reducing ever since the vaccines came in place. As long as there is no HIV vaccine or there is no HIV cure and all that we have in place is treatment, the HIV stigma is not something that will go on zero. Like, it's kind of like really hard to have that stigma eliminated. But as I always tell my young people, my fellow young people, is that it is easier for you to deal with stigma that is coming from the community, but it is very hard to deal with stigma that is coming from your own family. And to me, I think if I'm to ever advocate for any kind of stigma, that is the stigma that I don't think I can stand. That is the stigma that I think everyone should be up against for, because you can withstand anything else, but if it's coming within your own family, within the only people that you're living with at home, then it becomes very challenging. And the reality is, this kind of stigma is still living with us. When you go deep down in the villages, we still have children that cannot share food on the same plate with others just because they're living with HIV. We still have those stories. I mean, it looks like there are stories in the early 2000s, but even last week I was doing a home visit and I met this child who was being stigmatized in their own family. And to me, that is the most miserable part of it all, because I can withstand any stigma from anywhere else, but if it's coming from family, it just becomes very hard to deal with.
So after all these years, how do you assess the fight against HIV/AIDS globally in terms of challenges, progress, and opportunity? What is your assessment?
Thank you so much. So one thing is there's been treatment progress, from the number of pills to the side effects of the drugs, but also to clinical progress. Like if you take ARVs, they work. You will not fall sick. You will be like any other person. If your viral load is suppressed, your chances of transmitting HIV is very low. Elimination of mother-to-child programs, like, they have done wonders. We still have children being born to HIV, but that is not the case as it was before in the early 2000s. The period when most of us were being born, most of us that are in our 20s that were born with HIV, it's because EMTCT was not available. But currently the program has been successful. I think it has been one of the best programs ever to ensure that prevention of mother-to-child transmission is, you know, possible. And then we've also seen progress towards accessing HIV testing services, which is very crucial. Like, it starts with knowing your HIV status, because from there you will either get connected to care or you'll get connected to prevention services, which we need in place. When you look at the prevention services available, there's been a lot of development on pre-exposure prophylaxis, but also development on the post-exposure prophylaxis. I've heard that the injectables are in place. There are children who cannot stand tablets. And I met one child a couple months back. Whenever they look at a tablet, they vomit. Whenever they swallow a tablet, they vomit. And this child's viral load is very high. So I looked at this boy and I was like, I just pray the injection finds you quickly. So we need treatment options. And over the years, this is being availed to us, which is something that we need in the next 1 or 2 years, because not everyone is friendly with pills. not everyone will be friendly with injections. Like, we just need a variety of options available to us so that anyone who is HIV positive can have access to treatment in whichever format, and they can have their viral load suppressed.
Talk to us about your work with the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation and the sorts of progress that has been made over the years in the fight against HIV/AIDS.
Okay. So I started getting connected with the foundation as a beneficiary. And in my country by then, ECPAF was supporting a local hospital where I was receiving medication from. And at an early age, ECPAF understood the power of psychosocial support. You know, the clinical arm is important. Like, treatment is important. But if you only give me treatment and you don't take care of my mental well-being and you do not take care of my surrounding, I may not be in position to take the treatment. So from an early age, ECPAF supported me to get initiated into a psychosocial support group called the Area Clubs. And those clubs gave me a platform to meet other young children that were like me. But also those clubs gave me a platform to understand more about HIV and understand more how to deal with myself. Because some people are HIV positive, but they even don't know what to do. And, you know, when you go to the hospital to pick medication, sometimes you don't have a lot of time to spend with a clinician. So you need to spend this time with probably the counselors or to spend this time with the peer educators at the facility, which can only be done if there is a kind of like psychosocial support group. Because then, you know, in that support group, you're not discussing about clinical issues, but you're discussing about issues around stigma, issues about disclosure. Like, most people that were born HIV positive that are in their 20s currently, you know, we are dating, we are getting into relationships. So disclosure is a very big topic. But that is not something that you will discuss with a clinician. That is something that you will discuss with your peer, educator. So from an early age, ECPAF understood the power of psychosocial support, and that was my entry point in the foundation. So from being a beneficiary, I became a peer leader, and I started supporting my other young people to accept their status, to take their medication, to go to school, you know, like to live life like HIV is just a small portion in there. You know, it shouldn't define your entire life. And here I am currently. I serve now on the board of directors. So I've been a beneficiary, and then I've supported my other fellow young people, and then I've now brought my experience on the board to ensure that our voices are heard, but also to ensure that we are the center of our programming, but also at the center of making decisions.
As an ambassador, what is your message?
Well, that's a big one. But as an ambassador, I am lucky that I've been supported. I am lucky that I do not have to buy ARVs. I receive them at a free cost. I'm happy that I have access to treatment. I am happy that I have access to a family support group that understands me. But that may not be the case for many other young people. So my message out there to whoever is listening or to whoever is watching or whoever will read this is that we still need to work together to ensure that people living with HIV receive care, they receive treatment, but they also receive support from their other fellow young people or their other fellow colleagues that are living with HIV. The other message is that few children are being born with HIV. So science has proven to be right, but that does not mean that there is no child born with HIV currently. Certain children are still being born with HIV, yet we can revert that. So there is a lot of support and a lot of advocacy that is still needed to ensure that every positive, HIV-positive mother is identified early, initiated into care, and supported to ensure that at this age, really, no child should be born with HIV. Like, I feel bad when I go to a facility and I meet a two-year-old 3-year-old baby who is HIV positive. Like in this era, it is really so sad. So I think we still need to do a lot of work to ensure that all over Africa, because that is where the burden is, all over Africa, we still don't get HIV positive children.
Josephine Abukenya, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
That was Josephine Nabukenya, activist and an ambassador with the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including Senate Republicans downplay the impact of the House January 6 hearings, which have shed new light on former President Trump's role in the attack on the Capitol building to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election victory. Join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Welcome back to Health Chat. The ongoing drought devastating the Horn of Africa has hit Somalia the hardest, with an estimated one half of its 16 million people facing crisis-level food insecurity. Aid groups say hundreds of thousands of Somalis are at risk of starving to death, as reports emerge of children dying of malnutrition. Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
This stabilization center for malnourished children in Somalia is run by an NGO, Action Against Hunger. It serves mostly poor women living in IDP camps on the outskirts of Mogadishu. Fadumo Madey left Govgadud village, a rural settlement in the southern Somali bioregion, after three of her young children died of malnutrition. She now lives in an IDP campus with three of her remaining children.
Before the drought, we had livestock and farms that grew crops, but the drought destroyed them all at once. I had three children who died from malnutrition, and the child on my lap is suffering severe malnutrition because of the ongoing hunger crisis.
The larger number of displaced women with malnourished children, mostly under the age of five, is overwhelming for hospitalists. Families escaping the ravages of drought from all regions of Somalia see Mogadishu as their only hope. Aisha Aden is from Sako town in Middle Juba.
We cannot grow crops and our livestock have died. The situation of our children as well as our lives are in dire danger. May God be with us.
Doctors say there is a risk of malnutrition that can cause more deaths if it is not addressed soon enough.
Dr. Abdulsaq Yusuf works and supervises the malnutrition ward at the Martino Hospital, where he's also a director. He says there is a shortage of nutritional foods for children.
They must be given a therapeutic diet, such as milk with nutritional value for the vital strength required for malnourished children. The supplies that were donated to us by the United Nations are depleted now.
Meanwhile, at an IDP camp just outside Mogadishu, women and their young children wait outside their makeshift shelters for help. And the camp's caretaker says families in desperate need of help arrive daily.
On a single day, 10 vans with displaced people can arrive. The next day, 4. Other days, we have no new arrivals. Every day has its own challenges. There is always something different. You can see families being dropped by vehicles all day, and they walk to this camp. That is the reality here.
Aid groups say the Somali government lacks the capacity to mitigate the severe drought and malnutrition crisis. And without more help, the situation will grow even more grim for children. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
Millions of bottles of Australian baby formula have landed in the United States. Yet the baby formula shortage continues, with women going to extreme measures to feed their babies, including buying breast milk from strangers on social media. Senior Washington correspondent Caroline Prisutti shows us the impact.
He's excited. Yeah.
One-year-old George crawls and coos as he reaches for his bottle. He's in for a treat this morning. His morning formula is mixed with cereal. Mom Lindsay Cates is slowly transitioning to whole milk as she shows us her last carton of formula.
Would go to the next grocery store and then go to the next grocery store, and I would send my husband out on little manhunts to, you know, check out the CVS, the Target, the Whole Foods to see if we could still get it.
Last month, formula started disappearing from store shelves. Supply chain issues were blamed. Contamination and recalls led to the closure of the nation's largest formula producer, Abbott Laboratories of Michigan. Moms resorted to Facebook and the drastic decision to buy breast milk from strangers.
I'm a mom of five.
Heather Christian of Minnesota, with six-week-old Isabel Jadry, is selling her breast milk for $1 an ounce. One customer buys $50 worth a week.
You can't produce any milk, and you can't go buy the formula because it's not there. What are you going to do to feed your baby?
Abbott's Michigan baby formula plant is now open, but Amy David, who teaches supply chain management at Purdue University, predicts shortages will continue to September.
We also know that some of the ingredients used in baby formula are going to be harder and harder to get because of other things going on in the world, such as the dependence on sunflower oil from Ukraine.
By the time formula cans fill the shelves again, George and other wee ones will be moving on to soft food and cow's milk to grow big and strong. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Washington.
A growing number of people are turning to bio-wearable devices to help them manage their health conditions and improve their lives. VOA's Julie Tabo reports.
Fred is an avid gardener, a hobby he gets to enjoy more of these days now that his diabetes is under control.
Before, when I used the test strip, I was more worried about my diabetics. Now I feel that now I have a hand in controlling my diabetes. That gives me more peace of mind.
That's thanks in part to a device he wears on his body that continuously tracks and records his blood sugar levels so he and his doctor can be better informed. The data has helped him make lifestyle changes that have improved his glucose levels. Fred asked that his last name not be used to protect his privacy.
This device helped me to manage my daily diet, and I was able to achieve the goal that I had.
A growing number of people like Fred are turning to wearable devices to help manage their health, to track their walking steadiness, or simply monitor their lives. 11-year-old Sophia Panchal recently received an Apple Watch for her birthday.
I use my Apple Watch to check my steps, my heart rate, and my general activity levels.
Consumers can share that data with their physician. Richard Milani is a cardiologist and the chief clinical transformation officer at Ochsner Health System in New Orleans. He spoke with VOA via Skype.
I can get gait analysis off of your iPhone. And moreover, I can detect falls off of an Apple Watch. In 1 week, I'm getting the same sample that I would normally be getting in a year. So this is really changing how we're viewing preventing and managing, you know, our population.
For many people, the privacy and security of their health data is a concern. Again, Dr. Richard Milani.
We want to be able to have reliable data that's secure from a patient protection standpoint.
Fred's device is made up of a sensor that attaches to his body. He enters a code into his smartphone and data is transferred via a transmitter.
When you think about your something in your heart or your blood pressure or your blood sugar, you constantly get obsessed with it. With this, that obsession is out of the picture.
Technologies are being developed today that will be even less intrusive, gathering health quietly through devices like smartwatches and phones, Dr. Milani says.
The ideal technology is something that's completely passive. I don't have to even know how to do anything. It's just doing it behind the scenes, and then it'll let me or whoever I designate know whenever there's an issue that I should be concerned about.
That's good news for Fred, who'd rather spend his time out of doctor's offices than in his garden. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more news and health coverage, visit VOA Africa.